Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, Race for the Senate. We get the latest from Georgia ahead of Tuesday's runoff election. Then a new lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs over decades of discrimination against black military veterans.
It was totally a disgrace to me and my family, and the fact that we was denied benefits that I was rightfully entitled to.
And a brief but spectacular take on student loans and rethinking what it means to be in debt. All that and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. It's good to be with you. We start tonight in Georgia, where early voting ended yesterday in that state's Senate runoff election. That contest is between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger Herschel Walker. Neither won a majority of votes last month, which forced a runoff. Georgians swarmed to the polls ahead of Tuesday's vote, setting a new record for single-day early in-person turnout. Our Laura Barón-López is on the ground in Atlanta for us. Laura, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
And give us a sense of how Warnock and Walker have shifted their messages, if at all, in this stage of the race to reach potentially new voters.
Walker is really focused right now on trying to win over those 81,000 voters that voted for the third party Libertarian candidate in the general election. And he's been talking about that on the stump. He's also really just, though, been focused on not really a more moderate message. He's talking a lot about culture war stuff. He is equating voting this election campaign to whether or not Georgians want to go to heaven or hell. He talks a lot on the stump about gender identity and about transgender people being allowed to play in different sports. And so that's what his stump speech is really focused on, which doesn't sound as though it's trying to reach those moderate voters or even win over those voters that voted for Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who has been recently trying to boost him in the runoff election, a change from the general election. As for Warnock, Senator Warnock has really been focused on health care. He's also been making a democracy pitch to voters, telling them that Republicans were trying to prevent voters from voting on weekend early voting, and that his campaign, along with other organizations, sued and ultimately won that. And Warnock's campaign is feeling very bullish ahead of the Tuesday runoff.
Well, on the early voting, there has been record-breaking turnout, as we've said. Do Democrats see that as a good sign for the Warnock campaign? And what are officials there saying about the long lines that have greeted early voters across the state of Georgia?
Democrats do view that as a good sign for them heading into the runoff. They feel as though the more people that are voting, the more likely Warnock could potentially prevail. They also feel as though enthusiasm is not lacking on their side at all. Officials in Georgia, state officials are saying, the Secretary of State's office has said that those long lines were always going to occur and that they are a sign that there isn't voter suppression. But black-led organizations that are focused on mobilizing voters that I've spoken to while I've been out here disagree. They say that those long lines ultimately make it harder for voters to vote. Some voters have been waiting in line longer than an hour and a half to 2 hours to try to cast their ballot in early voting. And they also say that that shortened time frame that was caused by the restrictive voting rights voting law that was passed last year, that instead of having a month to register new voters for the runoff, they weren't able to register any new voters ahead of this runoff versus 2 years ago. They also say that that shortened time frame, it went from having 3 weeks of early voting, roughly 3 weeks, to now basically 1 week of early voting, and that all of that makes it harder for voters to cast their ballot.
On a separate note, Laura, as you well know, this past week, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, voted to adopt President Biden's recommendation to overhaul the 2024 presidential primary calendar. So what that does, it slingshots South Carolina into the leadoff position, followed later by New Hampshire, Nevada, Georgia, and Michigan. Drawing on your experience covering national politics and the White House, give us a sense of the rationale behind that decision and how it's being received by Democratic officials.
I was in Iowa during the 2020 primary, Democratic presidential primary, and it was chaotic and it was a madhouse, and that really pushed a lot of Democrats to vocally call for Iowa to no longer be the first state, the first caucus for the Democratic presidential primary. Also pushing that is the fact that a lot of Democrats want a state that is more reflective of what they say is their voting base, more diverse, that has black and brown voters that are more populous in those states. And so that's why they appear to be right now going with South Carolina as the first state. But ultimately, we won't know the final decision. The final vote won't occur by the DNC until early 2023. And here in Georgia, speaking to some local organizers, they, of course, would love for Georgia to go earlier on in the calendar. But there could be complications there because of the fact that the DNC is going to have to find a way to work with the GOP state legislature in Georgia, as well as the Republican governor in Georgia, and get to move Georgia up in that primary calendar. And there could be complications there, as well as the fact that New Hampshire is deciding that, is saying vocally that they ultimately are going to still try to be the first primary in the calendar because their state law gives them the power to do that.
That's a good point. Laura Barrón-López in Atlanta for us tonight ahead of Georgia's runoff election on Tuesday. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, former President Donald Trump today took to his social media platform calling for the termination of the U.S. Constitution to overturn the 2020 election, citing conspiracy theories about election fraud. The twice impeached former president has repeatedly called for his reinstatement, but this marks the first time that Mr. Trump has said the Constitution should be suspended so that he can seize power. State and federal judges dismissed more than 50 lawsuits presented by the former president and his allies challenging the results of the 2020 race. According to a number of early polls, Mr. Trump is the likely favorite for his party's nomination in 2024. China is showing signs of easing its strict zero COVID policy after rare displays of dissent across the country. In several major Chinese cities, including Beijing, a negative COVID test will no longer be required to enter public spaces or to use public transit. But officials there say the zero COVID policy remains intact, as public health officials report tens of thousands of new cases in just the last 24 hours. Iranian state media today said that construction has started on a new nuclear power plant. The announcement comes as tensions between Washington and Tehran remain high over sweeping sanctions imposed after the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Meantime, Iran is also downplaying the human toll of the widespread anti-government protests that have rocked that country for months. State media today claimed that only 200 people have died since the protests started. But human rights organizations in Iran believe the number of dead and detained is much higher. Cascading lava from the world's largest active volcano, Mauna Loa, is creeping closer to a major highway on Hawaii's Big Island. Officials say the oozing wall of molten rock could reach the Inouye Highway sometime next week. It's the quickest route connecting the two sides of the island, and if it's rendered impassable, officials say it could add hours to commutes.
We have such limited roadways on this island, and anytime we lose a roadway, it just shifts all that traffic to somewhere else.
Geologists say that Mauna Loa's eruption could continue for another 1 to 2 weeks. And the U.S. men's soccer team's hopes of a World Cup title ended today, falling to the favored Dutch 3-1. The men's team had not advanced past the first knockout round since 2002, and had lost or tied all 12 of its games against European opponents at the World Cup since then. Team USA can now set its sights on the 2026 FIFA World Cup, when they'll play before home crowds. The U.S. will join Mexico and Canada to host that tournament. So save the date. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, black military veterans sue the VA over decades of discrimination, and a brief but spectacular perspective on student debt.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The U.S. government has discriminated against African-American military veterans dating back decades, disproportionately rejecting disability claims from black veterans at a much higher rate than white veterans. That's according to a new lawsuit filed in federal court this past week by Yale Law School's Veterans Legal Services Clinic. The group filed the suit on behalf of Conley Monk Jr., a Vietnam War veteran whose VA benefits were denied for nearly 50 years. He's joining me now, along with Richard Brookshire, who served in the U.S. Army before co-founding the Black Veterans Project. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And Mr. Monk, you enlisted in November 1968. You served in Vietnam, but you were wrongfully denied an honorable discharge, which meant that you received no VA benefits. The VA denied your applications for education, housing, and disability benefits before finally agreeing in December 2020 that you were, in fact, eligible all along. How did the lack of VA benefits affect your life?
It really damaged me by this, not letting my family receive any form of benefits. I couldn't receive any benefits and neither could they. So my kids was not entitled to educational benefits, which they should have been entitled to. They could have also got some sort of the stipend while they was going to school. And also the fact that I couldn't even get my job back. I worked for the VA when I left to go in the military. And I came home, I couldn't get my job back. I joined, I did not get drafted, you know, so I wanted to go to fight for my country, to be involved in the Vietnam War. I felt that I was totally robbed of my rightful dues when I came back from Vietnam. I served honorably in Vietnam, you know, I was involved in a lot of, you know, different combat actions. It was totally a disgrace to me and my family, and the fact that we was denied benefits that I was rightfully entitled to.
Richard Brookshire, you created the Black Veterans Project, which is a nonprofit that researches the inequities that black veterans face. After you struggled to get the resources you needed when you came back from Afghanistan, give us a sense of your story. And why do you think these hurdles have persisted across generations?
Yeah, I served as a combat medic for 7 years. Four of those were on active duty, three of them in the New York State National Guard, and had a difficult transition, you know, out of the military that I wasn't actually anticipating. I wasn't taken seriously by the VA. So I found myself, unfortunately, on the other side of a suicide attempt. And it just so happens that after that attempt, I started to really engage the Black veterans community. But I'd also started to engage, like, what are the disparities? Like, I mean, I'm living with them. I'm starting to see them. But getting a better sense of the numbers was kind of like the first instinct for me. So we went to Yale and said, hey, like, you know, we want the most contemporary data to kind of look at, are there disparities in disability compensation? Because I've heard about disparities of the GI Bill at the turn of World War II. I think Conley is a perfect example of how dishonorable discharges have perpetuated, locking many Black vets, even to this very day, out of access to their benefits.
And Mr. Monk, to Richard's point about the sort of generational aspect of this, you come from a family of service members. Your father fought in a segregated unit during World War II. Your siblings were also in the armed forces. And you make the point that you and your siblings could have gone to college potentially if your father had gotten the benefits that he applied for and was denied back in the 1940s.
Yes. And you know, it continued. You know, after my father, my daughter, my baby girl, she had to struggle to work and go to school, and she owed $100,000 on a student loan at this present date. She's now a principal in one of the major high schools, but, you know, we suffered. We sustained an injury, and we continue to. And I think it snowballed down to, like, my grandkids. You know, my grandkids, they would have had a better chance of going to school if they would have been entitled to the monies that their mother could have got to go to school to help them out. And not only that, the housing benefits. You know, we was denied housing benefits, where I could not get a housing loan. My father had to work two full-time jobs in order to provide a living situation for us. So, yeah, it really damaged my family, me and my family.
Well, we reached out to the VA to get a statement in response to this lawsuit. And without addressing the merits of the suit, we got this statement that reads, part of which reads this way. Secretary McDonough has made clear that delivering world-class, timely, equitable care and benefits to all veterans is our top priority at VA. Throughout history, there have been unacceptable disparities in both VA benefits decisions and military discharge status due to racism, which have wrongly left black veterans without access to VA care and benefits. We are actively working to right these wrongs, and we will stop at nothing to ensure that all black veterans get the VA services they have earned and deserve. Richard Brookshire, the VA is acknowledging that, yes, there's a problem. I guess the question is, what should be done about it?
Fostering equity is great and noble, but it's not redress. I think this administration has been really supportive, but I also think that there's been decades to do something about this. Like, we're 75 years out next year, looking at the fully integrated force that we have now. And it's a time for a reckoning, and it's a time to account for the history and the ills that have been done and at the hands of the VA.
Mr. Monk, what are you hoping that this lawsuit filed on your behalf achieves?
Well, I hope that it opens up the door for other vets to not be able to be blocked just like I was, where they can go ahead and get their disability benefits without being discriminated against. Reparations and compensation is what I think should occur.
Conley Monk Jr. and Richard Brookshire, I thank you both for your time and for your insights. This week, the Supreme Court announced it will hear a case that will decide whether the Biden administration can broadly cancel student loans. Tonight, we hear from one of the millions of Americans affected by student debt. Astra Taylor is a writer, filmmaker, and political organizer. As a young adult, she says she was forced to default on her student loans, prompting her to join the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2011. Since then, she has been speaking and teaching about debt. Taylor shares her brief but spectacular take.
It's a couple years after the 2008 financial crisis, and I was struggling to pay my student loans, and I defaulted. I couldn't pay. And I remember getting this phone call and the person on the other end saying, you've defaulted on your loans, and so that means your principal is going to go up by 19%. So my balance ballooned, and you know, your credit score is shot. And so now I just owe even more. Like, the problem's just even worse than it was. At that moment, I felt really alone and overwhelmed by my situation. So I grew up in Athens, Georgia. You know, I was told basically, you know, you need to get into as fancy a school as you can, or you're not gonna have opportunity in life. And so at 17, I enrolled at Brown University. And yeah, at 17, you know, I had to pay for it. I vividly remember being in the, you know, in a big auditorium with what felt like dozens or hundreds of other teenagers signing the loan papers, taking out loans to go to school. When I defaulted on my student loans, I felt overwhelmed, I felt ashamed, and what I didn't realize at the time was just how common my situation was. I mean, now I know that two-thirds of Americans are in debt. I know that 45 million people have student loans. I know that a million student debtors default every year. I know that 50% of Americans struggle with medical bills. I didn't know that then, but I started to realize it one day when I went to Occupy Wall Street. And I actually realized everyone here is in debt. And that was a really powerful moment. Individually, being in debt can be really overwhelming, but when you come together with other debtors, those debts can actually make you powerful. There's a saying that we like to quote from this industrialist. If you owe the bank $100, that's your problem. But if you owe the bank $100 million, that's the bank's problem. Together, we own the proverbial bank, right? That's the kind of power that debtors can wield when they realize that their debts are someone else's assets. The Debt Collective is the country's first debtors union. A debtors union is a form of organization that people can join to wield power collectively. Just like workers come together in the workplace to demand higher wages and benefits, better treatment, our idea is that debtors also need to come together. Many of the debts that we now hold today didn't exist a few generations ago. Again, a few generations ago, college was free or close to it. Medical costs were not so exorbitant. So debt is a systemic problem. A systemic problem requires a systemic solution. We're taught to think that debt is our fault, but the fact is, you're not in debt because you live beyond your means. You're actually in debt because you're denied the means to live. I'm Astra Taylor, and this is my brief but spectacular take on debt abolition.
Finally tonight, some happy news to share. We have a new member of the PBS News Weekend and NewsHour family. Our colleague Allie Rogan and her husband Josh welcomed baby Anne at the end of November. We are overjoyed for Allie and her family, who says they can't get enough of baby Anne's chubby cheeks, blue eyes, and full head of light brown hair. Allie will be away for the next few months, but don't worry, she'll be back here with more of her excellent reporting next year. Congratulations, Allie and Josh. Online right now, a look at the controversial history of Georgia's runoff elections ahead of Tuesday's vote. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for tonight. On Sunday, we look ahead to next week's Supreme Court hearings on redistricting and a clash between free speech and civil rights. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at PBS News Weekend, thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us.